Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions are brought to us by the websites onthisday.com and cracked.com. Question number one. It was on this very day, back in which year, that the Star-Spangled Banner was adopted as the national anthem? Was that A, 1779, B, 1812, C, 1888, or D, 1931? The national anthem, which year? And question number two, what is the meaning of the song, Jimmy Crack Corn? Was it A, some dude fell off a horse and died, let's get hammered? Was it B, the morning of the death of a corn-loving slave driver? Was it C, inspired by a recipe for making cornbread? Or was it D, the importance of serving others before attending to your own needs? Jimmy Crack Corn. What is the backstory? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of March the 2nd. Well, it was on this day back in 1877 that the Tchaikovsky ballet Swan Lake debuted. Now, Swan Lake is a romantic ballet in four acts. Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky wrote the music. Swan Lake is about a prince named Siegfried. He falls in love with a swan princess. Well, she is a swan by day, but a young woman at night. And it was 87 years ago today, back in 1931, that the first jazz album to sell a million copies was recorded. It was Minnie the Moocher by Cab Calloway. It became the signature song for Cab Calloway and his orchestra over the next decade. Beloved by audiences, Minnie the Moocher earned Calloway the nickname the Heidi Heidi High Man, based on his unique form of scatting in the song, a call-and-response scat battle that Calloway used to engage the audience in when performing this song at the Cotton Club and other famous jazz nightclubs in Chicago. The song tells the sad story of a red-hot hoochie-coocher girl named Minnie. The hoochie-coochie was a style of belly dancing with non-respectable gypsy origins and was considered lecherous at the time. In 1999, Minnie the Moocher was given a Grammy Hall of Fame award. And we'll close out today's program with Cab Calloway singing the 1999 Grammy winner, Minnie the Moocher.
On the road again, just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. And I can't wait to get on the road again.
And in country music news, we have this article written by Marisa R. Moss and published in the February 8th through 22nd, 2018 issue of Rolling Stone magazine. Margot Price won't back down. After a heartbreaking debut LP, she's blasting Trump and her country peers and drawing her biggest crowd yet. A A few days ago, Margot Price's husband, Jeremy, and her 7-year-old son, Judah, discovered a moonshine barrel on a hill behind their brand new home, located 20 minutes from downtown Nashville. "I went. I gotta see this. I can't be left out," Price says, milling around her retro wooden kitchen in jeans, a white tank top, and denim shirt. She climbed up a steep, stony incline and found it. "Then I saw 8 more, just built into the ground," she says. "It was really surreal." Price's area, she learned, was once heavy bootlegger territory. She jokes about bringing the barrels out of retirement for a little home brewing. It makes perfect sense that this discovery would excite Price, whose songs routinely find beauty in scenes of decaying America, dried-up farmland, burned-out factory towns, and the people who never escaped. After more than a decade of struggling in Nashville, Price, 34, broke through with 2016's Midwest Farmer's Daughter, which chronicled her blue-collar upbringing in rural Illinois as the daughter of a prison guard and her later struggle to reclaim her life after years of personal devastation, including the death of her infant son, Ezra. The album was a critical hit, earning her a spot on Saturday Night Live and duets with her heroes Loretta Lynn and Willie Nelson. Price has emerged as a rare liberal voice in Nashville, blasting Trump, the FCC, and the country stars who stayed silent on the issue of gun control after the Route 91 Harvest Festival mass shooting in Vegas. Price felt she had to speak up on that issue. Her dad would frequently bring home food he'd hunted. "There's something beautiful about that," she says. "But we didn't have high-powered machine guns when this all started." Today, Price has worked up about a visitor in town, Donald Trump, who's about 12 miles south speaking to farmers. "I don't understand how people think that some rich guy that has been handed everything his whole life knows anything about the struggling working class," she says. It's a question that hovers over her new album, All American Made. Recorded remarkably quickly after her debut, it's looser, funkier, and politically sharper than Midwest Farmer's Daughter. One highlight is Heart of America, about how her parents worked on their farm around the clock, only to have the government take it away. She was aiming to write a modern-day version of John Prine's classic coal country lament, Paradise. Like Prine, Price admits to stretching the truth when necessary. Prine's family said, "That's not actually how it went," she says. And he said, "Well, it rhymes." Price's success has given her plenty of new topics to write about. She calls out gender wage inequality on Pay Gap, a honky-tonk waltz written after she discovered she'd been paid less than a similarly famous male performer at a festival gig. On Wild Women, she chronicles her hedonistic life on the road and the hypocrisy she's experienced getting called out for it. "All the men, they run around and no one bats an eye," she sings. "Women are not going to put up with it anymore, and it's amazing," says Price, who last year told Rolling Stone about the time a sleazy manager spiked her drink at a business meeting, an incident that caused her to leave Nashville for a while. "I don't know when actual equality will come or if we need to burn more bras, but I'm happy to see some things come into light, even if they're kind of painful." Price is still getting settled in at home. You can tell what matters to her by what's been unpacked and what hasn't. Stacks of cowboy boots sit by the front door. Endless notebooks sit on bookshelves and a Shinola record player, a gift from Chris Stapleton and his wife Morgan, shines in the living room. "I broke down and I got a flat screen, but no one has hung it up yet," she says. "I like it better without it anyway." She prefers spending time in the backyard watching her son play. It hasn't snowed yet, so he's been sliding down the hill on pine needles. "That's how a southern boy sleds," she says. The rural scene reminds her of her own hometown, of Aledo, Illinois. Once the Walmart came in, though, things hit the big time. Her time at home won't last long. In a couple weeks, Price kicks off a long tour that includes 3 nights at Nashville's famed Ryman Auditorium, which she used to stare at longingly when she waitressed at a bar down the street. She's already thinking about her next record. She has about 22 songs written, which she describes as being in a new direction, sonic and genre-wise. Her 2-LP deal with Jack White's Third Man Records is up, and major labels have called. She doesn't have an off switch, says her husband. When she's on the road, she's giving everything she has and looking out after her band and crew. When she's home, she's taking care of her son and doing laundry. I've never seen anything like it, but we're not complaining, says Third Man's Ben Swank. Though she tries to keep up the Willie mantra of staying stress-free, the grind is wearing on her. Another new challenge in navigating her new fame. Price has been thinking about how to talk to her son about it and making sure her family stays humble, even if her career continues to take off. She recently found herself in Walmart wondering if she'd be spotted by an antihistamine medication for the hives she's been getting lately. She finishes telling this story, and Jeremy and Judah bound through the door and take out burgers and fries with them. Price smiles. It ain't all caviar and limousine, she says. Frederick Delius's A Song of Summer introduces our classical music news, and it's an article from WCPE's Quarter Notes, December, January, February 2018 issue, entitled Lately We've Read, Delius and Norway. This is written by Andrew J. Boyle, the Boydell Press, and the review is written by R.C. Speck. Students of the Romantic period of music know well that nationalism was all the rage for a good part of the 19th century. Often a composer drew great inspiration from their nations or ethnicities or from the majestic geography of their native lands. Frederick Delius was certainly one such composer, but with a twist. He was English, but became fixated on a foreign land in his music, that of Norway. Author Andrew Boyle chronicles Delius's love affair with his neighboring nation and illustrates clearly how landscapes, particularly mountainous ones, can become reflected in music. Much of Delius's love for Norway stemmed from his close relationship with Norwegian composer Edvard Grieg. The two shared, among other things, a love for walking and hiking, and it was Grieg who took Delius on his many tours of the mountains of Norway. Pieces such as On the Mountains and Over the Hills and Far Away were in part results of Delius's love for Norway. Boyle takes On the Mountains down to its musical notation to show how themes such as peaks and plateaus play out in the composer's imagination. A regular in the salons at the end of the century Paris, Delius rubbed shoulders with many famous artists, including Paul Gauguin, Auguste Strindberg, and Edvard Munch. He also formed a relationship with Norwegian nationalist author Knut Hamsun. He expressed his left-leaning politics and may or may not have had meaningful relationships with some more radical personalities. But the mountains of Norway also and always beckoned, and whenever Delius had the money, he visited to get, quote-unquote, his old self back. Boyle goes into great detail surrounding the low point of Delius's career in Norway. In 1897, after a bitterly contested election regarding Norway's independence from Sweden, a satirical play featured a piece of music from Delius, which made fun of the Norwegian national anthem. After this, Delius was persona non grata in the land that he loved. But even this event could not shake Delius's self-confidence. After the turn of the century, he found great success in Germany and England. With his wife, Joka, he continued to visit and stay in Norway whenever he could. Even as his health declined after World War I, Delius could not sacrifice his frequent sojourns into Norway. He composed the tone poem, Eventyr, the last of his odes to Norway, during this period. Norway inspired Delius to compose around 33 pieces. These were drawn either from his own experiences or from Norwegian poems, the texts of which he set to music. And Frederick Delius, Andrew Boyle, found not only a fascinating subject, but an opportunity to show how a nation can inspire one to compose great music. Lucia Micarelli grew up on classical music. She's since devoured jazz, pop, and rock. This is an article written by Ed Condren, published in the News and Observer on the 26th of January, 2018. After Lucia Micarelli won a violin competition while coming of age in New York, she headed off to Sizzler to celebrate. "That was my reward, and I would order the steak and baked potato and just live it up," Micarelli recalls with a laugh. "It was the coolest thing for a kid. It was what I lived for." And what happened when Micarelli, 34, failed to take first place? "It was back to the practice room for me," she says. Endless practice sessions paid off for Micarelli, who has become an acclaimed violinist with an esteemed resume. Micarelli, who performed recently at the Cary Arts Center, has made a name for herself as a solo recording artist. But before she struck out on her own, the musician, who is of Korean and Italian heritage, toured with Chris Botti, Josh Groban, and Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull fame. "All of those guys were amazing with me," Micarelli says. "It continued my education." Her first big break was a gig with Trans-Siberian Orchestra a decade ago. "That was my first experience with a massive show," Micarelli says, calling from her Los Angeles home. "I remember when I got the job, they asked if I had an electric violin, and I didn't. They made me one specifically for me. The big rock thing that TSO does was alien to me at the time, but it worked out well. Rock was so new to me." Micarelli, who grew up strictly on classical, devoured other styles of music as she became an adult, including jazz, pop, and rock. "I remember the first time I heard jazz in a New York club, and I was like, what the hell is this? I was just blown away," she says. "Then I immersed myself in classic rock with Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. It was super cool. But I grew up so much after being with TSO and being exposed to many cool styles of music for the very first time." She sat in with New Orleans street musicians and met Cajun fiddle players. She met Steve Earle, too, a musician she admired. "I got to play with him, which was awesome," she said. "Steve pushed me to write a song, so I'm so indebted to him. I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. I learned so much about music, and I fell in love with a unique city." Her solo albums have included compelling versions of such classics as David Bowie's Lady Grinning Soul and Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. An Evening with Lucia Micarelli, which was filmed in Santa Barbara, California last summer, will air on PBS in March. "That was amazing," Micarelli says. "How often does a musician get a night like that on PBS?" Even though Micarelli has been playing many different styles of music, she still reaches back for classical. "I do it for my mother," Micarelli says. "When I was doing an HBO drama from 2010 to 2013, I wasn't playing classical. My mom would ask, 'What's up with that?' One episode I worked out that I played some Felix Mendelssohn. I told my mom that it was for her. I put all of my heart and soul into classical when I was a child. It wasn't an easy childhood. When other kids were out playing, I was practicing indoors. But if I didn't work so hard, I wouldn't be doing this today. So now those kids are adults working inside, and I'm out playing all around the world with my violin, thanks to my parents." ¶¶ And in Music Research and Technology, we have this article entitled, Behind the Music. Being part of a community band or choir has many unexpected benefits. This is published in Renew, United Healthcare. And this is the February 2018 edition. Flexing those vocal cords or dusting off that acoustic guitar may help you build new friendships and boost your health and well-being. Consider joining a community band or local choir and reaping the rewards that being a member of a musical team can bring. Singing in a choir or playing an instrument in a band or orchestra is about more than just making beautiful music. Participating in music groups has all kinds of physical, cognitive, and psychological benefits as well. Being part of a choir or band builds community and can even relieve symptoms for those suffering from depression. Participating in a group and creating something together has been found to improve well-being, and music groups have been shown to help quell symptoms of anxiety and improve overall mood, a bonus at any age. Singing with others has also been shown to regulate heartbeat, lower blood pressure, improve lung stamina, as well as strengthen the immune system, according to a 2016 study by Tenovus Cancer Care and the Royal College of Music. Such benefits have even made their way to the Big Heart Big Screen in the touching documentary Young at Heart, which follows a choir of seniors living in New England. The members, whose average age is 80, share how their lives have been transformed since joining the group, a first for many of them. Being completely new to music isn't a barrier to reaping the health rewards. According to a study published in the Hearing Journal that tracked adults 60 to 85 years old, those without any musical experience improved processing speed and memory after just 3 months of 30-minute piano lessons and 3 hours of practice each week. But there's good news for those who have played music earlier in life, too. The cognitive and neural benefits of musical experience continue throughout life. It may even counteract negative effects of aging, such as memory and hearing difficulties in older adults, according to reports shared at a symposium in California that explored musical experience and hearing loss. So whether you want to learn an instrument or join a choir, decades of research has shown that music brings richness to our lives in more ways than one. An instrumental cover of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror introduces today's local music news. Coming up this next Thursday, March the 8th on 2018 at 7:30 p.m. in my Mandy Concert Hall, Raleigh, the music of Michael Jackson. From his early years with the Jackson 5 to his mega hit album Thriller and beyond, Michael Jackson stormed the music industry with hit after hit. A full rock band and vocalist joined the North Carolina Symphony to jam on ABC, I'll Be There, Beat It, Rock With You, The Way You Make Me Feel, and many, many more. Go to ncsymphony.org or phone 919-733-2750. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day back in which year that the Star Spangled Banner was adopted as the national anthem? Correct answer? Answer D, 1931. The song was originally known as Defense of Fort McHenry. As noted in the article Nine Things You May Not Know About the Star Spangled Banner by Christopher Klein, published in History.com on September 12, 2014, it did not become the national anthem until more than a century after it was written. Along with Hail Columbia and Yankee Doodle, the Star Spangled Banner was among the prevalent patriotic airs in the aftermath of the War of 1812. During the Civil War, the Star-Spangled Banner was an anthem for Union troops, and the song increased in popularity in the ensuing decades, which led to President Woodrow Wilson signing an executive order in 1916 designating it as the national anthem of the United States for all military ceremonies. On March the 3rd, 1931, after 40 previous attempts failed, a measure passed Congress and was signed into law that formally designated the Star-Spangled Banner as the national anthem of the United States. Key, by the way, was a one-hit wonder who might have been tone-deaf. And the answer to our second question, what is the meaning of the song Jimmy Crack Corn? And the correct answer? Answer A, your master fell to his death off his horse. Let's go get a drink. As John Crose notes in crack.com, this song was called Blue Tail Fly when it first appeared in 1840s. The original lyrics weren't Jimmy Crack Corn, but rather Jim Crack Corn. If you actually read through the full song lyrics, it tells the story of an unhappy slave whose job is to follow around his horseback riding master and shoo away the flies. However, a blue-tail fly bites the horse, causing it to buck, and the master is thrown and killed. An investigation follows for which the slave avoids being blamed for the death. Now, remember what we said about the refrain, that it used to be Jim Crack Corn. A quick search of the old English dictionary finds that Jim Crack, or spelled G-I-M-C-R-A-C-K, used to mean cheap, and corn was shorthand for corn whiskey. In other words, what at first sounds like a lament from a strangely loyal slave suddenly reeled like a man is kicking back and enjoying some cheap booze after his jerk master's accident. It makes way more sense this way. Nobody would mourn the death of a corn-loving slave driver, but of course, an oppressed slave would celebrate his temporary freedom with a cheap bottle of rotgut. We're not saying the song is bad or anything. Rejoicing at the death of evil isn't necessarily evil itself. Still, it means your children are singing a song about getting messed up on Everclear to commemorate the demise of a slave owner.
Folks, here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a red-hot hoochie-coocher. She was the roughest, toughest frail, but Minnie had a heart as big as a whale.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.
The King of Sweden, he gave her things that she was seeking.